morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. Call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Today we have a number of bills that are scheduled for public hearing and possible work session. We are going to start off with Senate Bill 388, so open up a public hearing on 388.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 388 increases the number of Court of Appeals judges from 10 to 13 on July 1st, 2012, appropriates monies from the general fund and declares an emergency effective on passage.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Chief Judge Brewer. Come on up.
Why don't you sit in the center, because I'm going to get yours tonight.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Paul DeMunis, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court and the head of the Judicial Branch of Government. I'm here today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 388. The Court of Appeals was created in 1969, and it was created to provide access and the timely resolution of appeals in this state. For the majority of Oregonians, the Oregon Court of Appeals is the last stop. It's the final resolution of their case. Almost from the beginning, the Court of Appeals has been recognized nationally as one of the most productive intermediate appellate courts in the country. From its very existence, from its very beginning through today, it's been blessed by dynamic leadership, starting with Chief Judge Schwab and today with Chief Judge Brewer, who joins me at the table. There comes a time, however, when dynamic, innovative leadership, creative and thoughtful ways of processing cases is simply not enough. And we have reached that place today. The Court of Appeals has not had one single judicial position added in 35 years. We have now reached a place where the volume of the caseload and the complexity of the appeals that those 10 hardworking judges must handle is beginning to threaten the very reason for why the Court of Appeals was created: access to justice and timely resolution of those cases. I had the privilege of serving on the Court of Appeals for 10 and a half years, and so I know how that process works. I know how hard those 10 judges are working. We are at a stage in our history where our Oregonians are in need of increasing the judicial positions on this branch of government so that we can remain true to the original calling. We can remain true to provide access to justice and provide timely resolution for those Oregonians who the Court of Appeals is their last stop in the process. As I've said in other settings, our courts sit at the intersection of political, economic, social. We handle cases involving families, criminal law, and today, importantly enough, one of the things that is suffering is our Court of Appeals resolution of economic disputes. At more than ever in our history, we need to make sure that we are timely resolving economic disputes, because if we don't, there will be a continuous negative impact on our economic recovery. I'm joined at the table with Chief Judge Brewer, who will provide to you the details that I think are necessary. We recognize that this is a policy committee. We recognize exactly what we're asking. But in order for this bill to get a hearing, to get resolved, we need to make sure that it moves on to Ways and Means. I want to thank you again for the courtesies that you've provided the Office of Chief Justice and provided to me personally, and I'd like to turn it over to Judge Brewer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, it's always hard to follow Paul DeMunis because he has a way of capturing the essence of situations so ably. But I think it's my role here this morning, without taking too much of your time unnecessarily, to set the table and provide a little more background for this policy request, SB 388. I want to just make 3 points clear, and I know you all know this, but it makes me feel better to say it. First, please understand that every judge and staff member of the Court of Appeals is grateful to serve the people of Oregon, and everybody on our court considers it to be a tremendous privilege to play a meaningful role in our public justice system in this state, or we wouldn't be with the court. And we also greatly appreciate the partnership we've had with the legislature under the stewardship of the Chief, including your passage of important efficiency legislation in the 2009 session that has helped the court through parts of the budget storm that we've experienced in the last several years. And then, probably most importantly, the elephant in the room. Just please know that we're all so very mindful of the challenges that you face in balancing all of the critical interests that will help you pave the way to Oregon's future in this legislative session. So much rides on the decisions you make, and our judicial branch and the Court of Appeals is particularly respectful of the difficult choices you have to make. The background for the timing of this bill is that when I became Chief Judge of the Court in 2004, it was clear to me that the court had been very stoic for a number of years and really probably had neglected having some pretty serious adult conversations with the legislature and with our other constituents about our workload and about the pressures that the court was facing and the effect it was having on the timely administration of justice. So over a period of time, even though we really didn't have funding to do a meaningful report, I knew and our court knew that it was absolutely critical that we make a workload assessment. So largely, this came to fruition with the leadership of the Chief and the State Court Administrator a year and a half ago. We obtained a federal grant through the State Justice Institute that allowed us to retain the services of the National Center for State Courts to do a weighted caseload workload study for the Court of Appeals. It's only the second of its kind that's been done in this country for an intermediate appellate court. It's the first one that's ever been done for a court that's adopted institutional performance measures. So what we had was an opportunity to weigh our workload against the performance measures that the court has adopted in areas of productivity, timeliness, efficiency, and quality of our work. What the National Center, which is the state, the national body that all of the states belong to, that provides resources, the technical support for our state court system around the country, what they found in a report that was issued about 8 months ago was absolutely no surprise to me. And in a nutshell, it's included in the annual report that we provided you with copies of both previously and today. That report found, based on timekeeping that everybody on our court made and other in detail research and investigation, that in order to simply decide as many cases that it takes under advisement as come in each year, the court needs at least one more panel. In order, that's three judges, in order to actually reduce some of the other congestion and efficiency problems we have, including a 70% affirm without opinion rate, it would take substantially more than that. Our court has not grown, as the Chief said, judge-wise or staff-wise in a meaningful way in over 33 years. But in the meantime, the complexity and density of our caseload has grown dramatically. You'll hear in a couple of minutes from representatives of the Attorney General's and Public Defender's Office about the increasing density and complexity of their work. That's just a part of it. But the workload study showed that we need 3.5 judges just to tread water, as I describe it, which means to decide as many cases that we take under advisement as we take in. That study is available online. It's linked, and we provided an executive summary in the entire study to Legislative Fiscal Office 6 months ago. And so John Borden and others in that office have had a chance to discuss it and consider it in detail. The court probably has one of the most complex array of cases in the country of any court, ranging from all manner of administrative review, workers' comp, mental commitment, land use decisions, to the most complex business and commercial decisions, and matters involving the economic interests of individuals, along with a very dense and complex criminal docket, as complex a docket as any appellate court in the United States. Yet, as the workload study indicates, compared to other courts with a similar caseload, we have about half as many judges and half as many staff as they do. And we've adapted to that dysfunction over the years by having a high number of cases that are affirmed without a transparent decision, which doesn't hold us accountable, in my view, properly to the people of this state for a valid explanation for the decisions. But it's also led to creeping delay. And that pressure is felt by our judges and our staff. The work has gotten done over the years by major sacrifices to the personal lives of judges and lawyers on the court, many of whom work 60, 65, 70 hours a week, year in, year out, just to do their best to keep up. In fact, this is the only job I've ever had where I had to actually talk to staff members and tell them they could not work uncompensated, unauthorized overtime because they'd exposed the court to an unfunded liability. And that's a chronic issue the court has had because of the level of dedication of folks and the concern everybody has about being so far behind. And with this challenging workload and the modest circumstances that the court faces, it's also increasingly difficult to attract and retain the right talent to do this critical work. Because as you can well imagine, with the volume and the time pressure we're under, getting the best legal minds and most productive folks energy-wise to aspire to the bench who are committed to public service is a real challenge, and that's something I'm very concerned about, and I'm sure you are too. But to bring these points home, what I'd like to do is just mention a few statistics that I think are particularly telling. Right now, in order to get an oral argument in our court, it takes an average of 5 to 8 months from the completion of briefing just to get an oral argument date. That's after the parties are finished with their briefs. Of cases taken under advisements, that's the cases we don't affirm without opinion, our clearance rate, that is, the ratio of cases going out to the cases going in, desirable is 100%, right, 1-to-1, is only 90-94%. So we're falling that much farther behind on cases taken under advisement. Right now, as of yesterday, I checked the stats, we have 386 cases on our court that have been orally argued or submitted on the briefs and are awaiting decision. And everybody on my court knows that. And that's the kind of pressure they all live under day in, day out. There are 73 of those 386 cases that have been under advisement for more than 180 days. And I know in your world, just like mine, that isn't acceptable. The way we've tried to deal with it, again, is just working nights and weekends. What I do is I take the civil cases that nobody else has time to do, and I work after I get home until sometimes midnight, 2 o'clock, writing those cases and all weekend long. And there are several other judges on the court that do exactly the same thing. Again, not a complaint, just a statement of fact in this conversation. So I've got plenty of other statistics that I'm glad to share with you, but I don't want to see your eyes glaze over or bore you too much today. I thought those would be the most significant for you to start out with. And as the Chief pointed out, in a world where you do your best to keep up, this court has also been the court that people, including the legislature, have consistently called on to get the heavy lifting done on cases that are really important to Oregonians and have to be decided quickly. And I'd sure like you folks to think about a couple of bills in particular, and that's HB 2130. That's the Urban Growth Boundary Review Bill in the House, and SB 766. That's the Industrial Siting Bill that's here in the Senate. Those are two absolutely critical bills to Oregon's recovery. And my understanding, my impression at least, is that they have broad-based support from both sides of the aisle, based on the understanding that getting those industrial siting decisions done quickly, getting urban growth boundary disputes resolved quickly so everybody knows where the balance lies under your policy determinations between protection of natural resources and economic growth is absolutely critical to the recovery of this state. Both of those bills provide for review in the Court of Appeals, and that's where it belongs. That's what we've done historically, and we're up to the work if we've got the resources. Both bills also would expedite the decision of those cases. And I point that out not to suggest that we in any way, shape, or form would shrink from doing that. But the hard, plain, simple truth is we have to figure out what we're not going to do if we're going to do it, unless the court is adequately funded. And so the last thing I want to do is to sit here with my tin cup in my hand when I know so many other important constituencies are really suffering in Oregon. But I know these adult conversations are absolutely critical, too, and I would be negligent, in my view, if I didn't bring these matters to your attention in the form of this bill. So as the Chief mentioned, we're asking you folks as a policy committee to look at the merits of this need, and if the bill can be moved on to Ways and Means for additional consideration. Of course, the court understands the pressures everybody's under, but that would be very helpful to us. We have four very brief speakers. Again, they've all been asked to say their piece in 2 minutes or less. I'd like to call them up here now. We have the Solicitor General and Deputy Attorney General of the State of Oregon, Mary Williams. We have the State Public Defender, Pete Gartland. And if Mary and Pete, if you could come up, they'll be followed by two other important constituents, Harry Auerbach, who is with the City of Portland and is the Chair of the Appellate Section of the Oregon State Bar, and Bob Maloney. Bob is a trial attorney and a commercial lawyer, and they will, after Mary and Pete speak, talk to you about the effect on commercial interests and on the appellate section and litigants of delay in our system. So I'll ask Ms. Williams, please, to address you next. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. I'm Mary Williams, Deputy Attorney General and Solicitor General. We have a letter from the Attorney General showing his support for this bill, and I want to speak briefly to one part of the state's involvement with the court. The state is involved in about 80% of the cases in the Court of Appeals, so we have a very broad concern with how the court is able to effectively resolve those cases. But I want to talk briefly about the largest caseload that we have there is our cases that are part of the Defense of Criminal Convictions program. So they're direct criminal appeals and they're appeals from post-conviction challenges to convictions. Over the years, we have worked very closely, and what you see here in terms of the three of us here together is not unusual. We see this as a system that involves all three parts, the state, the representation for the defendant, and the court. And it's critical that those three parts work well together because inadequate funding or resources for any one part of the system has the potential to just fundamentally undermine how that system is able to work. I often will meet with my counterparts in other states, and in talking about our work in the criminal cases in Oregon, we are in a very unique position because the three of us will meet monthly and sometimes more often as needed to try to find ways, recognizing our distinct roles in the system, but still finding ways to move things through as efficiently as we can. But that can only go so far. Without additional resources, there's a limit to what we're able to do simply by trying to work cooperatively where we can. Over the years, we've seen an increase in our cases in the Defense of Criminal Convictions area. We've seen a significant increase in the complexity of those cases, in part attributable to Mr. Gartland improving significantly the quality of the work that comes from that office. And over the years, we've seen increases in our resources for our office and for the Public Defender's Office. We have not seen increases, though, for the court. And so as we've worked hard, and in part because the legislature has given us additional resources, to bring down the time it takes us to do our part, we now are seeing that there continues to be lengthy delays in resolving these cases because the court is not able to do their part. Those concerns are both then practical and frankly, philosophical. The philosophical part is simply that, again, I'm worried about how this system functions and the need for all parts of the system to be fully solid and able to function for the system as a whole to work. But the practical concerns are that if we continue to have increasing delays for the direct criminal appeals, at some point there is there has to be an end to that. And what ends up happening is that the federal system is willing to allow the states to deal with challenges to state convictions because that's, frankly, the appropriate place for those challenges to occur. But if there is a point where the state system appears to be inadequate to resolve those challenges, the federal courts will step in. And that's the thing that we are always sort of most concerned about in these cases, because it increases the cost of being able to deal with challenges to the convictions. Our cases, when they go to the federal courts, cost 3 to 4 times as much as the cases as they're moving through the parts of the state part of the system. And in addition to increasing the cost, to be honest, the federal courts are not in the same position to understand the state law, and we have a concern, frankly, that we will begin to lose more of those criminal convictions as more of them may move to the federal courts rather than being resolved as they currently are first and primarily through the state courts. So it's a significant concern that we have. We appreciate the close working relationship that we have, but we also really urge you to consider providing additional resources to the court. Thank you.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Peter Gartland. I'm the Chief Defender with the Appellate Division of the Office of Public Defense Services. And I, too, am here in support of Senate Bill 388 and also out of concern for the Court of Appeals. I think both the Chief and Mary have touched on some of the items I was going to discuss, but I want to give you an idea about criminal cases, because we represent people on criminal appeals, juvenile appeals, dependency cases, and parole cases, and so my remarks are going to be directed just at the criminal appeals. We file about 700 what we call merit briefs a year in the Court of Appeals. That means those are briefs that have a legitimate issue that must be resolved by a three-judge panel on the Court of Appeals. Currently, the way our office is set up with our resources, we are filing briefs around 7 to 8 months after the case is ready to be filed. So a case will come in, and when it's ready to be briefed, it takes us about 7 months to file that brief. Then the Attorney General similarly has a 7 to 8 month lag before it files its responding brief. Now, in past years, the Court of Appeals would, when a case was set for argument, ready to be set for argument, it would take about 1 to 3 months for the Court of Appeals to put that case on a docket. Currently, the Court of Appeals is also taking 6 to 8 months to put that case on a docket. So when you add that up, we're looking at 20 to 24 months before a criminal appeal is even ready to be decided by the Court of Appeals. That's a two-year delay. That's a two-year lag before the Court of Appeals even considers the case. We think that that is obviously a threat to the judicial resources on the court, but it's also an intolerable delay for criminal defendants or any litigant to expect to have to wait 2 years before there is even a decision, even for the Court of Appeals to decide the case. And you heard the Chief this morning say that cases that are taken under advisement will last longer. So some of our criminal defendants are waiting 2.5, 3 years before there is a decision at this first level of appellate review. So we are here out of concern for the delay in the system and also the ultimate threat to the integrity of the judicial process with these delays and with these drains on the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. Before you step down, is there any questions for Peter or for Mary? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Mr. Chair, at this time, I'd ask that Harry Auerbach and Bob Malone please step forward and join me. And Mr. Auerbach will address the committee first.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing me to appear in front of you this morning. I feel like the fifth place hitter in the top of the order has cleared the bases, so there really isn't all that much left for me to say, except...
Need your name first.
My name is Harry Auerbach. I am employed as a Chief Deputy City Attorney for the City of Portland, and I am authorized to say that the City of Portland supports this bill. But I'm here today in my capacity as Chair of the Oregon State Bar's Appellate Practice Section, and we're made up of We have approximately 400 members who are the appellate practitioners who appear before primarily the Oregon Court of Appeals. I've submitted my comments in writing. A lot of what I want to say that the speakers before me have ably articulated. I will say by example that when I started doing appellate litigation 25 years ago, we were getting cases set for argument within weeks. You know, after the respondent's brief was filed, sometimes even before the reply briefs were filed, we'd get notice of an argument 6 to 8 weeks out, and we could count on when there were written opinions issuing, the standard time was 5 to 7 months from argument, we would count on getting opinions. It is now becoming routine for cases not to get argued until, civil cases, until at least a year after the respondent's brief is filed, and particularly in cases with any complexity at all, for opinions not to issue for a year or more after that. And it's not because the court isn't working hard. I mean, I've been hearing it ever since George Joseph was around. This is the hardest working group in show business, but it's true. They work very hard. They're very committed. The Chief and the Chief Justice have done, as I say, yeoman efforts to try to cope with the fact that they're being asked constantly to do more with less. But if you're a criminal defendant who feels he's wrongfully convicted, or if you're a prosecutor or a victim who wants to be able to get an evidentiary ruling reviewed so you can have your case, your justice in front of a jury, or if you're a civil litigant who is waiting for money that you've got coming to you, or if you have property that you can't develop because you've got ownership issues that are tied up in court, if you're a parent or a child or anybody involved in the family law system, the delays that are inherent in trying to get this first and for most people final level of judicial review in your matter have serious consequences on the most intimate facets of your life. And so I think it's critical from the point of view of practitioners and their clients that we make this investment to bring the court back to where it needs to be and to fulfill the promise of the Oregon Constitution to administer justice completely and without delay. That's all I can say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning. My name, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Bob Maloney, and I grew up in Klamath Falls, Oregon, where my dad had a small propane gas business, and the last 40 years I've been practicing law with the Lane Powell firm and had the pleasure of representing a number of large, medium, and small employers throughout the state in our court system. I think that we would all agree that infrastructure is very important to our economy and very important to businesses, because if we don't have a strong, supportive infrastructure that is user-friendly to businesses, they aren't going to want to come to Oregon from other states or from other parts of the world where we are looking for people to help our local economy. So that's what I am particularly interested in. And I have some experience there, too, because I was an owner of a major employer for 25 years, Norm Thompson Outfitters, here that has its roots here in our state, and I know the importance of a strong infrastructure. And an infrastructure includes not only our various state agencies, but it includes our court system, because businesses require our courts to help them sort out differences that unfortunately businesses get into and disputes. And if we don't have a good supporting infrastructure that includes our court system that can work in a timely and efficient way to resolve business disputes, we send out the wrong message to businesses. We send out the message that we aren't a user-friendly state that is interested in businesses locating here and helping our economy to employ people that we desperately need. So I urge you to support our Senate bill that is before you, and would remind us that, you know, we've heard that since 1977 we haven't added a single position to our Oregon Court of Appeals, but if you think back about what's happened in our state over the last 30 plus years, I think we can better appreciate the importance of adding at least one panel of judges to that. I think we talk about having too many lawyers in the system, but just remember, we've at least doubled the number of attorneys in the state of Oregon, and we haven't kept up pace by adding to our needed number of judges in our judicial system. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony. I wanted to ask Judge Brewer about, I know this isn't the Ways and Means Committee, but the bill talks about the judicial positions and the staff. Do you have an estimate of the cost, and do you have room for everybody over there, or will you need capital?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonamici, for that question. Policy option package that is a companion to this bill provides for a total cost for adding three judges and staff of $3 million in a biennium, because the bill would not call for judges being seated until July of 2012, there would be a reduced cost for the current biennium. As you reduce the number of additional judges, it roughly goes down proportionately. So if you added two judges for a two-judge panel, it would be two-thirds of that cost. In terms of the makeup of the staff, our current arrangement provides for, in a panel of three, there are two judges with two law clerks, the presiding judge has one law clerk, and there are a total of two staff attorneys. And so that staffing level, plus one and a half judicial assistants who do the clerical and processing work. So that staff ratio is carried forward into the policy option package calculation. I hope that answers your question.
Any other questions? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Pazanski. Chief Brewer, this bill calls for the governor to appoint these three individuals. Wouldn't it be more appropriate if they were actually elected?
Thank you, Senator Wissett and Chair Pazanski. Senator Wissett, additions to the court historically that occurred, and believe me, we considered that in deciding how to present this bill to the legislature, were structured in the way that this one is. So we, back in 77, when additional positions were added, this is the way it was done. And so we decided that we would present this as a proposal. And, of course, the legislature is free to decide whether it thinks there's a preferable way to do that. Please do recall that anyone who is appointed would have to stand for election at the next general election. But as your smile indicates, you know all too well, there are rarely opponents in those situations. And so I agree with that. The bill had to adopt an approach. It isn't the only approach, as you rightly and wisely point out, but it is the one that's consistent with history. And as you can well imagine, the Judicial Department and the Court of Appeals would thank the legislature for the additional resources, regardless of how those seats were filled.
Thank you. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. I just need to check to see if anyone else wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 388. I don't see anyone. We're going to close that public hearing. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 388.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 388 has no revenue impact. A fiscal statement has issued, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I will move Senate Bill 388 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent request a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 388 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, but with a prior reference and subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a golden opportunity to say on the record that I think Oregon is incredibly lucky to have not only Chief Justice Dominguez, but also David Brewer running our courts. They are men of incredible integrity, and I know he's chief judge, but
we all hesitate.
We
all hesitate.
I guess Judge Brewer and I have worked together on so many issues that we're on a first-name basis, but that's not appropriate here. I understand that. I guess one thing I want to say is, another thing is, in health care committee, on bills we have been sending to Ways and Means that are somewhat speculative, we have been doing it without recommendation, just not to prejudice what goes on in that subcommittee. On this one, I want to send it with as strong a recommendation as we possibly can, because I think this is a critical component of keeping our judiciary system functioning the way it should. And I do understand Senator Whitsitt's concern on this, but I think the bottom line for me is we need to give the appellate court the tools it needs to do their job, so I fully support this.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will support this as well today, but with the understanding that I think the fiscal here is probably 50% understated, in that it's the fiscal is probably accurate for this biennium, but it will roll up to probably more than twice that in the next biennium by virtue of the fact this doesn't start until these people wouldn't be appointed until 2012, and so the 13 FTE in support only show up as 7.5. So when we roll it up the next time, it's going to be more like 4 million or you know, and on up. And the second thing is the election of the judges. Like I said, I will support this. It's very likely we'll bring an amendment for the Ways and Means to make that an elected position. I really don't think it's appropriate to create new positions in the judiciary and then appoint them.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that this doesn't always happen in this committee, but I strongly agree with everything that Senator Cruz said.
All right. Senator Dinkfelder, any comments?
No.
The only thing I will say is I think this is very important. We've seen these gentlemen before us many times as to the workload that the Court of Appeals has. It's stellar to have those professional men and women that are actually serving our state in that position, but there is a time where we have to make more resources available to make certain justice is there. Regarding the what will happen in Ways and Means, that will be the next step. We'll allow them to do that. I understand, Senator Whitsitt, your concerns on the elections. I will say that based on what I've heard at this point, it appears that the timing of when they would come on board may not work with a general election, but again, that will be another question for Ways and Means to deal with. With that, any objection to the motion that's before us? So ordered, and there need not be a carrier since this will be going to Ways and Means. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 388, and we're going to go ahead and start at the top of the agenda with Senate Bill 31. And with a public hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 31 allows recipients in possession of any portion of cremated remains to dispose of the same so long as received from a person with disposal authority, provides immunity from civil or criminal liability for disposition of cremated remains by a cemetery with the consent of the person in physical possession of the remains, provides immunity from civil or criminal liability for cemetery for disposal of remains scattered without its knowledge, permits disinterment of cremated remains by the person in possession who authorized interment.
We have one person signed up to give testimony today. Ty, I'm not sure if it's Cochran or Cochran. Good morning.
Chair Zansky, members of the committee, my name is Ty Cochran. I'm with the Cemetery Association of Oregon. I really don't have a whole lot of testimony here. I have some written testimony. I'm here more to answer any questions or concerns you may have on the bill and possibly give you some examples if that's needed. So.
All right. Ty, thank you very much. Let me ask, I thought the description that council gave us was pretty explicit as to what this bill is going to do, what it will permit, as long as the procedures are set. Did anyone have any questions for Mr. Cochran? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify today on Senate Bill 31? Not seeing one. We're going to go ahead and close that public hearing. I believe this bill has everything in order that we can go ahead and move it today.
Yes.
All right, we're going to go ahead and open up work session on Senate Bill 31.
The Senate Bill 31, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 31 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 31 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions?
Mr. Chair, my yes vote on this is dependent upon Senator Monroe being the carrier.
I've already noted that he will be, absolutely will be. All right, any other comments or discussions? And at this point, any objection? I'm waiting to see if Senator Dingfelder makes it back to the room. She'll have an opportunity to vote if she's going to just check out. So ordered, and we'll mark Senator Dingfelder excused, but if she would like to vote, we'll reopen for that purpose. Thank you for coming forward. All right, we'll close that work session on Senate Bill 31.
You need to sign it.
And that one will be going to Senator Monroe.
Okay.
Absolutely. And we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is Senate Bill 418.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 418 allows a court to sentence community service in lieu of a minimum fine, declares emergency effective on passage.
All right. Mary Van Noll. Mary, why don't you come on up. Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 418? Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. My name is Mary Van Noy. I am a student at the University of Oregon School of Law. I am here today representing myself as a proponent of Senate Bill 418. My interest in this bill comes from my experience as a judicial extern in the Lane County Circuit Court. The problem this bill addresses is that presently trial court judges are unable to consider an indigent person's ability to pay before imposing a statutory fine for a violation, such as a traffic offense. Every day, judges hearing the traffic court docket are faced with folks, especially in this tough economy, who express an absolute inability to pay the minimum fine. This bill seeks to allow a judge to accept community service hours as payment for the fine. For example, there's a man from Florence who I'm familiar with who would be affected by this bill. His present income is $600 a month, Social Security income. He received a citation for a traffic offense, appeared in Lane County Circuit Court. His wife has since passed away from cancer the time she was terminally sick. He was unable to pay the fine even when given a payment plan. He wasn't able to meet the payments. His license was suspended by the DMV as a result of non-payment. He reappeared in circuit court on a for a violation for driving while suspended. He said that he had to drive his sick wife to medical appointments, so he didn't have a choice about whether or not to drive. So at this point, he's in front of the circuit court. In order to get his license, he has the additional fines on top of the original offense. He has fines now for driving while suspended, and if he wants to have the suspension released on his license, he'll have to pay additional fines. Throughout this whole scenario, his income has remained at $600 a month of Social Security income. I believe that this bill is needed in order to efficiently and fairly administer justice, that judges need an additional tool to be able to accept community service as payment from indigent persons. And I believe that this is what this bill allow. Society will, it's not a, it's merely an alternative to the fine. It wouldn't be removing the violator's need to pay their debt to society. Instead, we would receive the labor from their community service hours that can be, in Lane County alone, we have 200 agencies that work with folks providing community service that comes in the form of preparing food at food banks, delivering meals to seniors, working in libraries and local parks. It's clear that we need some amendments to this bill before it can be workable, namely recognizing that fines from violations are a revenue source. We will need language to limit limit the class of persons who are eligible for using having community service as an alternative to payment, and that would be namely indigent persons. I also understand that we need to look at how this will affect some particular minimum fine statutes, such as minimum fines that are set in safety school zones, in construction zones, and if policy-wise, if those should remain in effect as a deterrent for behavior. I also would like to pursue some amendments to clarify the procedure that would happen after a failure to complete hours, should that happen. Currently, the statute that's referred to in the bill, the community service statute, would place a contempt of court would be the most likely penalty in this case, and we may want to look at just simply that the fine would be reinstituted, or that the fine would remain if the person chose not to complete community service hours. So thank you very much for your consideration of this bill, and I'm happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Mary? Thank you very much for coming forward. And was there anyone else, again, who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 418? Not seeing them, we'll go ahead and close that public hearing. And I'm going to go ahead and make an announcement. I didn't check the work session bills that we have. We have one that's at the bottom of the agenda, Senate Bill 450. If you're here on 450, it will not be heard today. It is not ready. Apparently, we're waiting for either the dash ones and or the supporting documents, fiscal and revenue on that amendment. So that one will not be worked today. And let me just carry that over. So, and we will carry over 450 to our next hearing date, which is this coming Monday. I believe that is April 4th. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up our, I'm going to ask the committee to entertain a motion to consider the vote that we passed Senate Bill 31 to the floor with the intention to allow Senator Dingfelder to vote on that bill. Any objection? So ordered. Senator Dingfelder, how do you vote on Senate Bill 31?
I vote aye.
Senator Dingfelder votes aye. With that, we'll reflect in the records. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 31.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. And we will open up our next work session, public hearing on Senate Bill 815.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 815 authorizes the owner of real property to use transfer on death deed to pass real property outside of probate at the owner's death. Senate Bill 815 was requested by the Oregon Law Commission. Oregon does not currently permit transfers of real property directly to a beneficiary at death via transfer on death deed or beneficiary deed. Such deeds allow transfer of real property outside the probate process in the same way that a payable on death designation allows securities or cash in a bank account to pass outside the probate process.
All right. I have, looks like, a panel, Mark Comstock, Lane Shutterly, and Wendy Johnson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shutterly. I'm here actually wearing two hats this morning. One is as a member from Oregon on the National Uniform Law Commission and also as chair of the Oregon Law Commission. This bill comes to Oregon from the Uniform Law Commission. It was adopted and approved by the Uniform Law Commission at its meeting in 2009. And it proposes something that we do not have here in Oregon currently, as you heard from the excellent summation in the staff report, and that is a transfer on death deed that allows somebody to pass property on death by a non-probate means. This is a very citizen-friendly bill, since it creates a new opportunity to deal with real property in non-probate transfer upon death. I just want to speak briefly to say that you have before you in your packets a letter from the Uniform Law Commission that explains and supports this bill, and also, I think significantly, letters from the American Bar Association Commission on Law and Aging that has considered and endorsed the bill, also indicating that the bill has been endorsed by the Uniform the other letter, from the American College of Real Estate Lawyers. So you have national organizations that worked with the Uniform Law Commission in drafting this bill for presentation to the states. We had a broad-based work group through the Oregon Law Commission that looked at this and tailored it to the particulars of Oregon law to make it work with our real estate provisions and also with our probate code. Mark Comstock was the chair of that work group, and I will conclude my remarks by turning it over to him, but I do commend this bill to you as a very useful bill for citizens in looking at estate planning outside of what we currently provide.
Mark. Thank you. Chair Przanski, my name is Mark Comstock. I have had the pleasure and privilege of being a commissioner on the Oregon Law Commission for a couple of years. And I did chair the work group that considered this particular proposal that came from the National Center. And it was a broad work group that included real property title representatives, people that issue the title reports that are so critical to real property transfers, members of the elder law section and the estate planning section of the bar, as well as the real estate section of the bar. And I was there as a representative of creditors and specifically wanted to make sure that this bill was tailored to Oregon law to be able to fit with Oregon law to accomplish the task of making a mechanism where a person or a lawyer could create a transfer that was effective only at death of the transfer and would allow for the flexibility and also protect creditors, and that would include the state as a creditor that it often is in estates. This bill does specifically address all of those concerns in, and I will leave it to Wendy to address any specific questions, but I just want to indicate that this bill does not change the effect of how the state would claim against an estate or a transfer. Quite frankly, it has been passed in 13 states across the country, and the experience in those states has been very positive as a tool for both estate planners and people to be able to transfer on death, similar to a payable on death bank account or securities account. Be pleased to answer any questions.
Wonderful. Thank you. Any questions for anyone? Oh, Wendy, were you going to testify?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel. In your packets is a report that details every subsection of the bill. There's also a summary, one-and-a-half-page summary. Sorry, Senator, couldn't get it to one on this one, with bullet points that outline each of the main points. But I think my colleagues have explained the bill. It really is another tool. We did take into account creditors' concerns. Creditors have 18 months, basically, to go after that property if there are their claims that can't be met by the probate estate. There were concerns from the Department of Human Services. We think we've addressed those as best we can. We can't really avoid fraud on the part of a decedent if they've lied about what property they have, but this will provide a protection for creditors to go after that property to recoup Medicaid reimbursement, for example, or child support reimbursement. You can go after that as an in rem claim. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, if I may, just one last comment.
Might be a question after you ask.
I don't think I will, but just for the record, I want to point out Section 29 of the bill that refers to the Law Commission making available a commentary approved by the Commission on the website of the Commission. This has become something that we have incorporated into Commission bills more and more, and it refers to the report that you've been provided, and very useful for practitioners and for the public who really want to know what's the backstory, what's the real, you know, how does this work beyond just the black letter of the law. So the report that you've been provided, which will become part of the legislative history now, is specifically referenced in the bill and will be made available on the website of the Commission, so that in the future anybody who wants to know the history of this bill and a full explanation of its provisions will have that report available to them on the Commission website.
Great. Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions? I will say there is Rick Mills is here from DHS if there are any questions. So if anyone wants to see how that interplays, I think he's available for that. Not seeing anyone. Thank you all very much. I'm going to go ahead and just, well, I should ask if there was anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 815. Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. This bill is not ready to work. Apparently, we're waiting for paperwork to catch up with it, so we'll get it scheduled once everything is together. With that, we'll close that public hearing, and we will open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 867.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 867 authorizes the Department of Environmental Quality to make agreements affecting activities on real property as a means to reduce exposure to hazardous substances, requires recordation unless agreement specifies otherwise, makes such agreements valid and enforceable with any conveyance or assignment of interest in the property, declares emergency effective on passage. There are two amendments. The dash one refines terms throughout the measure, including the definition of institutional control, referencing grantor and grantee rather than the parties, permitting such agreement where reasonably related to remediation as determined by the department. The dash two incorporates the refinements in the dash ones and adds one more refinement to insulate the agreements against those who acquire subsequent interest in the property. This bill was requested by the Oregon Law Commission to codify an existing department program that uses interest in real property as a means to make, to manage risks associated with hazardous substance contamination.
All right, thank you. Before y'all get started, I had one other person I'm going to go ahead and bring up. Charlie, is it Landman? Wasn't sure about trying to read the writing there, so if you'll come forward as well. And Jeff and Wendy, whoever wants to start.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Dobbins. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Law Commission. And the essence of this bill is, as committee staff stated, to ensure that contaminated properties can be marketed and redeveloped in a way while making sure that any limitations on the use of that property, in order to make sure that that contamination doesn't harm individuals in the future, last well into the future. In essence, this is a real property bill. The basic idea here is that even under existing law, DEQ enters into agreements with owners of contaminated properties under which those owners agree not to use the property for particular uses that might endanger the public or the environment. The difficulty is that under some traditional property law doctrines, the validity of these kinds of agreements can be called into question. The work group, and this is a work group that was sponsored by the Law Commission because there is a uniform act that does things very much like this bill, but the work group was reasonably confident that DEQ has the authority and that these agreements are enforceable going forward, but in order to ensure that there wasn't any risk in the future with respect to the validity of these agreements, the bill essentially borrows the best points of the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act and incorporates them into Oregon law. And in essence, what it would do is ensure that none of these traditional doctrines of property law would interfere with the enforceability or validity of these agreements, and that these agreements would be enforceable against future property owners as well. I think that's the basic summary of the bill. I'd be happy to go into further detail. I would point out that we have given the committee copies of the Law Commission report, which the Law Commission has reviewed and approved. And like with the last bill, there are provisions in the amendments that would provide that the Law Commission is required to post the report on the website of the Commission for the reference of the public and people who might be using the bill. I should also say that the Law Commission recommendation to the committee committee is a recommendation to pass with the dash two amendments, because those are the ones that are the final refined version of the work group and the law commission's recommendations.
All right, thank you. Wendy?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, again, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel, just here to answer questions.
All right, and Charlie.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Charlie Landman. I coordinate the state's prospective purchaser program, and I provide policy advice to the cleanup program. And I'd like to thank the commission for the opportunity to participate in the work group. I thought it was a really great conversation, very productive, and the department is here to offer our support for the bill. I would take this opportunity to point out that the state of Oregon has one of the earliest and one of the most highly respected cleanup programs in the country. When I go to national conferences, and I work with a lot of developers, a lot of landowners, when I go to those conferences and people say, oh, you're from Oregon, God, we wish we had that program here. And the institutional controls are a key component of this. We think this will strengthen our program. So we thank the commission and offer our support.
All right, thank you. And I assume that you're also in support of having the Dash 2 amendments adopted.
Chair Brzezinski, we are.
All right, any other questions or comments? Senator Whitsett.
Yeah, thank you. I just need a little clarification of the current process. This appears to be an administrative takings of the institutional controls. What is the current opportunity for judicial review of this takings, and specifically, how would this, the passage of this bill, change that ability for judicial review?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsett, thank you for the question. These aren't so much, I guess what I would say is that these are cooperative agreements between the landowner and the DEQ. Now, admittedly, they're done in the context of what is DEQ's overall enforcement authority, but under existing law, DEQ says we can either clean up the property, or if we have to, we can leave the contamination in place, but we can only do that if we place particular limits on the uses of that property. So rather than having to spend the money to clean up the property to a pristine state or to a state that might avoid all possible impacts on the environment, what these current agreements allow is the property owner to say, yes, we agree to those limitations, and it's just a matter of carrying those forward. So there's not really any judicial review of these, but I'd offer, see if maybe Mr. Landman has any other thoughts on that.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsett, Jeff's characterization is accurate. These are voluntary agreements, and they're an enormous benefit. They came out of a 1995 retooling of the cleanup law to move us to a risk-based system. Before that, you did have to clean up to essentially no contamination. We found out, gee, it's enormously expensive to try and do that. And so this is one of our key tools to manage contamination in place. It's effective, it's efficient, and it's really a tool that I think just about everyone in the state likes who works with it.
One particular instance that comes to mind is one near Klamath in the Northridge area. It has to do with asbestos, and
it does.
The many folks, including the original owners, believe that the allegations made by DEQ were beyond specious, but they certainly agreed eventually, because they had no recourse, to this involuntary takings and put the limitations on the property, because there was no recourse. You can either do it that way if you don't do it the DEQ's way, then you end up with the requirement to clean it up yourself, which is impossible to do because the standards set were impossible to reach. So, I mean, I have a real difficulty with codifying something more into law that has no where there's no ability to for judicial review. This just gives an agency the opinion. In my opinion, it gives the agency the ability to express a concern, to quantify the concern, to prosecute the concern, and to adjudicate the concern. It just doesn't work for me. Thank you.
All right. Any other comments or questions for the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 687? Did I say that wrong? 867?
Okay. Oh, I did say 6. Yeah, 867. Thank you for the...
Just to make sure we're paying attention.
Yeah. All right. Not seeing anyone coming forward, we will close the public hearing. Now, this bill is actually ready to move forward if we want to. Do we want to go forward today, or would you like to sit on it for...
We sit on it.
Yes. All right. So we will... Well, we've closed the public hearing. We're going to go into our other work sessions at this point. I want to open up a work session on Senate Bill 67.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 67 was previously heard on February 24th. It has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. This is the one that allows the Department of State Police to publish specified information about predatory sexually violent sex offenders on its website by city, zip code, or county. It declares an emergency as an effective on passage. It was amended, as I understand from the previous testimony, to avoid conflict. The Senate Bill 408, that is the -1 amendment, requires the request for information about juvenile sex offenders to use the offender's full name. And I believe Vi Beatty is in the audience, should the committee have any questions about the amendment or the bill.
All right. So we do have an amendment we need to consider for adoption. And if anyone has any questions before we move forward on that, we could bring Vi up to have her here to answer questions.
Okay.
Let's go for
it. Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 67.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment into for Senate Bill 67. Any questions? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 67 as amended by the -1 amendment to the 403 due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 67 as amended by the -1s to the 403 due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
A question. Could the counselor, somebody explain where the -1 amendments came from?
Yeah.
Who was around the table?
Where's Vi?
There were some concerns.
Vi, why don't you come on up?
Thanks.
Close. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. For the record, Vi Beatty, manager of the Oregon State Sex Offender Registry with Oregon State Police. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch the question. The
question is regarding the -1 amendments. Where did they originate from and why do we have them?
The -1 amendments actually originated from my office. I had been in conversation with the Juvenile Rights Project, now the Youth Rights and Justice, and Oregon Youth Authority. The if you're looking at the -1 amendment, where we inserted as a result of a conviction, that was at the request of Oregon Youth Authority to deconflict a ongoing conflict they had in release of information, because there was a shall release clause in the previous statute which conflicted with another statute that they operated under for release of information on juveniles. This took away the shall release on juveniles, left it just with adult convictions. The second part was to remove juveniles under supervision from the list information, so that the only way an individual requesting information on juveniles could obtain whether or not they were a registered sex offender is basically to call either a local law enforcement agency or the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registry and give a name and find out, is that individual a registered sex offender?
Any other questions? Any other comments? Any objection to the motion to adopt the -1s into Senate Bill 67?
I already did that. Where is the motion?
No, I think she had a question as to where it was. I don't think.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the -1s were moved into the.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then there was a discussion on the second motion.
I apologize. So the motion before us then is moving Senate Bill 67 as amended by the -1s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any objection? So ordered. And the chair will carry 67. And we're going to go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 387.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 387 was previously heard on March 10th. It has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral. This is the one that revises the Uniform Income and Principal Act, clarifies that individual retirement account or similar retirement plan held by trust established for the surviving spouse's benefit, qualifies for federal estate tax marital deduction, provides a formula for calculating amounts that the trust must distribute to beneficiaries, and amounts that the trust may use to pay taxes when the trust is required to pay taxes on entity which the trust holds interest. Declares an emergency is effective on passage. There is no amendment. And I can read the background.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 387 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 387 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objections? So ordered. I think Senator Dingfelder was really anxious to carry this one, but I'm going to ask Senator Bonamici to carry this one. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're both welcome. All right, so now we're going to open up our last of our work session bills for today on Senate Bill 397.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 397 was previously heard on the 3rd of March. It has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral. This is SIA. Allows an action based on tort to be brought against officer, employee, or agent of the public body if a complaint alleges that plaintiff is entitled to damages in excess of the Oregon Tort Claims Act limits. This is a further refinement of Senate Bill 311 from 2009, which attempts to insulate the tort cap and was previously testified to by the folks from the Oregon Health Sciences University. There is a dash one amendment that limits the total combined recovery to a single occurrence, and I believe Ms. Wason and Mr. Pulvis are available to answer further questions.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and ask Amy and Murray if y'all would come forward. I think we need to just get some stuff on the record just to make certain we understand what the dash ones will do and what they're intended to do and not intended to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Amy Wason. I am Vice President and General Counsel at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 397 with the dash one amendment. One sentence, I know we've had a long hearing already, but one sentence before I do so. I wanted to just, as one a representative of one of the many institutions across the state that benefited from the passage of Senate Bill 311 in the 2009 legislative session and the substantial savings that resulted from the increase in the cap, I wanted to thank the legislature and all involved for that effort. Just to recap what we covered it on the 3rd of March, Senate Bill 397 amends the Tort Claims Act to allow an individual that's bringing a claim alleging damages above the caps, above the current high caps, to name individual defendants in the lawsuits brought. That's a change from the current law, which has what's referred to as the substitution provision that provides that where a claim is brought against a public body upon motion, the individual defendants who are officers or employees of the public body are dismissed from the lawsuit, and the lawsuit proceeds against the public body as the sole defendant. The reason for this change is to further address some of the messages articulated in the Clark case. What the Senate Bill 397 does not do is to change basically who writes the check in the instance of any award of damages against either the individual or the public body. In other words, the public body remains obligated pursuant to current statute, and a statute that will continue unaffected, to defend and indemnify, meaning pay the defense expenses and pay for any damages awarded against an individual defendant. The Senate Bill 397 also does not change the amount of the damages that can be awarded, and that is the particular focus of the Dash 1 Amendment. Since our testimony before this committee on March 3rd, we have been in contact with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and we agreed to provide this testimony to make clear our shared understanding of the Dash 1 Amendment. And that amendment was offered not to change anything substantive in the Senate Bill 397, but to make more explicit the intent of that bill with respect to circumstances where an individual plaintiff sues more than a single individual and or a single entity. in such circumstances, regardless of the number of governmental bodies or individuals named in a lawsuit, and regardless of the number of claims asserted, there is a single per-claim limit that would remain in place and a single aggregate damages limit that would remain in place for all claims asserted. In other words, if an individual claimant sued two public employees as well as a government entity, that person's damages would be capped at today's total cap applicable to the state and OHSU of $1.6 million. For that single occurrence, notwithstanding the number of people names, and that is just exactly as if the injured person had sued only the governmental entity. What the Dash 1 Amendment also does not do is alter the right of a party to pursue directly to the Oregon Supreme Court an appeal related to the constitutionality of the cap. At the time that the 09 legislature substantially increased the limits, it wisely adopted ORS 3274, which provides that with a challenge to the constitutionality of the tort claim limits, including the 2009 amendments and including, if adopted, this Senate Bill 397 and the Dash 1 amendment, that appeal would be brought directly, could be brought directly to the Oregon Supreme Court under circumstances that are called out in that statute. This important direct appellate path remains available after passage of Senate Bill 397 and the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I am going to just ask some questions back just to make certain the record's this clear. It's my understanding that the intent of the Dash 1 is not to impact the holding of Clark.
Well, Mr. Chair, my name is Roy Pulvers, and I'm an outside counsel representing Oregon Health and Science University in support of Senate Bill 397, and thank you for the question and the opportunity to make clear that Senate Bill 397 is intended to be responsive to the court's expressed constitutional concerns in Clark, just as Senate Bill 311 in 2009 in its own way was intended to be responsive to the court's expressed constitutional concerns in Clark. It is, in our view, an important role for the legislature in the dialogue with the court in trying to fashion a constitutionally adequate remedy with the substantially raised tort cap limits for the legislature to engage in this exercise.
All right. Then the other couple of points I wanted to just clarify and make sure everything's on the record is that the Dash 1s will not impact the naming of the individual along with the entity consistent, again, with the holding of Clark.
If you could clarify the question, I would be grateful. I want to be sure that I'm responsive.
Does the Dash 1s have any impact on naming the individual along with the entity consistent with the holding in Clark?
Well, the Dash 1 amendment, as Ms. Wason stated, is consistent with and a part of Senate Bill 397, the effect of which is to provide for an opportunity for the individual who has alleged an injury above the amount of the cap to name and maintain an action against an individual government employee, officer, or agent. The Dash 1 amendment doesn't change anything with respect to Senate Bill 397 in that respect. It simply makes more express, although Senate Bill 397 itself did as well.
311?
I beg your pardon. So let me try to be responsive to your question. The overall effect of 397 is to provide for a cause of action against an individual to be maintained when the amount of a claim exceeds the amount of the damage limits in the cap. That's what 397 does, and if I understand your question properly, the Dash 1 amendment doesn't change that.
Okay. All right. I was asked to kind of put that on the record, so I want to get that there. Any other comments based on those statements that were put on the record?
Senator Bonamici, look like you.
Yes, I'm trying to go back and review my notes. Could you please remind us, is there a reason why post Senate Bill 311, those who are claiming injury are not bringing a claim against the individual? Was there something in 311 that forbid that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, the answer to your question is no, there certainly is not anything in Senate Bill 311 that forbids that, and as a general matter, in cases certainly where the claim exceeds the amount of the cap, it's common practice to name the individual as a defendant. At least that's our understanding. Moreover, as in Clark and Ackerman, in the event that a court concludes that the cap limits are not an adequate remedy, the court has in fact entered judgment against a named individual in those cases. And both Clark and Ackerman, of course, being old cap cases pre-311, but to the same effect.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bosomici, if I could just add one comment. The substitution provision remains in the statute now, however, so that with the naming of an individual defendants, there is still the substitution provision. And what we're proposing is that that would not operate to eliminate the individual defendants in cases where the damages are asserted above the cap.
All right.
I thought I was in full understanding here, but now I'm confused just a wee bit. I thought what we're doing here, and the part of the purpose for the amendment was to ensure that basically, in farmer's terms, there's one bite of the apple without whose name, and the caps are still in play. And this isn't. I just want to make sure this isn't an end run around anything.
No, it's, Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, that's exactly correct, and that's exactly correct.
Thank you.
So, in a farmer's way, you want to make a motion on
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash one amendment, Senate Bill 397.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment, Senate Bill 397. Any other discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 397 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 397 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, tort reform is going to be a issue much discussed this legislative session. At one point, we were considering using this as a vehicle, but we have chose not to. This is a good bill, and we didn't want to mess it up.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry 397 to the floor. And with that, I believe that takes care of our work. Again, 450 is carried over till this coming Monday, which is April 4th. And colleagues, as much as I know some of us would like to maybe not be here at 8 a.m. on a Monday, we have to be here at 8 a.m. on Monday, April 4th. With that, we're adjourned.
No problem.